Hello. I want to use our time today, whatever today means, to go back a little bit over ground that we were on last week, and to talk about our common project, which is how to reinvent one's practice, as well as one's time in law school. I recognize that our effort to understand the nature of violence in its relation to the lawyer's life is not complete yet, but it's as complete as I think it needs to be made. The way in which we think about John Brown and Martin Luther King Jr. and the substance of the problem of radical injustice as we face it is not merely a problem of violence. It's also a problem of courage, which is what we didn't necessarily have room to talk about, and which, as I looked at the conversation in the ether pad and the journal entries that came from last week, the more I thought about it, the more I understood that while I wanted to begin where I began, and for reasons which around this time of the year always seem to me good enough reasons to begin there, it's also important this time to remember the other part of this story of the conflict with lawyering with radical injustice, which is the nature of the courage, not just the courage of lawyers, the courage of clients, the courage of communities, the courage with which all of us collectively and individually face what we fear and what we do not know, which are often the same thing. It's easy to see the line that separates John Brown and Martin King. It's easy too to see, at least I hope it's easy to see, suggested in their mode of facing death, what is their courage. That is, in the etymological sense, what's in their hearts. The view that each man takes on the edge of what we are pleased to call eternity, I just want to do God's will, may not literally resonate for me. I'm neither Christian nor a believer, and their individual Christianities, not quite the same, and each very deeply felt, they're neither their Christianities nor their concept of God's will is directly relevant to me in my life. I don't feel the universe the way they feel it, but I know exactly, nonetheless, what each of them means. What's in their hearts, their courages, as Chaucer would have called them, what's in their hearts, their deep moral self-sufficiency, their sense both of insight and responsibility, the imminence with which they are required by their understanding of the nature of the universe as a moral entity to do what they have to do. I know that part of myself. It's not a unity, of course. As we remember the multiplicity of personality, we understand that the nature of the feeling state, which is bravery, is not the same as the identity state, which is courage or integrity. In the presence of multiplicity, what does integrity mean? If we know ourselves to be conflicting things, in what does our integrity consist? But though each of those men may seem in one or another respect incomplete to us, though each of those men may seem more multiple to us than he seems to himself, that this is true of John Brown, I suppose, is more likely to be available on the surface of the story. I think in order to appreciate the complexity and extraordinary multiplicity that is Martin King, it is probably important to get to its biographical essence, which, for all the public-facing qualities of both Taylor Branch and David Garrow's work on King, I think comes remarkably through. But what I think is important, justifying for us trying to understand how to shape our own lives as lawyers, what is important to us, I think, is the understanding that integrity is not the denial of multiplicity. It's simply the assertion that all of us, that chorus of us, whatever we are, facing our public responsibilities in relation to both justice and injustice, we're ultimately accountable to ourselves, to what it means to be a self in this world, multiple as it may be. We are accountable to something which, as a constitutional commitment in our own community of one, is how we know that we can all get along in here, inside ourselves, that we can, in the English idiom, live with ourselves for what we've done. In most human beings' lives, there are recurrent necessities to live with things we cannot live with, hence dissociation's survival value, which is absolute. The splitting of the self that follows from the living with that we cannot live with trauma in the beginning, and with all the other forms of immensely painful complexity that life puts us through as sentient, feeling, conscious animal beings, all the things we live with that we cannot live with, our own failings and weaknesses, those of others, the harms we do, the harms that are done to us, we do dissociate. But in the end, the goal of the human life is to transcend those dissociations, to live with all of ourselves as ourselves, and to live not merely in the sense of to survive the traumas, the pains, the griefs and the misdeeds, but to live with ourselves in that deep companionship, that acceptance and understanding and criticism and recurrent efforts to do better, which is the good life that we live with ourselves. We can see how for some lawyers that's more difficult than for others because of the material in which they work, but also because of the way in which they work at it. That neither John Brown nor Martin King can be proud of every single thing he's done in his life is not why they are proud to be who they are. And we, whatever is our form of work, the one we choose, at any given moment to put our minds to, bolstered by our licenses and our networks, whatever it is we choose to do, we also, of course, will never be without remorse, without regret, without self-reproach, perhaps even without self-condemnation. We are, I think, at a moment where if we were in a room together, if we could actually see one another in our discussion, it would be important also to probe the question of why it is that, to me, justice and injustice are not mere opposites. Why it is that in the formulations we sometimes have exchanged on the pad, in the journals, in our interactions since we ceased to be in the same room together, the idea of justice and injustice as mere opposites has become analytically valuable. If I say there are two motives for going to law school that seem durable to me, one is the love of justice and the other is the hatred of injustice, it is easier, I think, for some of you than it is for me to treat those as though they were mere, linguistic pairings in which justice and injustice are simply the opposite of one another as hate and love are. That's not how it feels to me, and there is something important in the trial of John Brown and in the moment of self-reckoning that came to Martin King the night before his murder that seemed to me to shed some light on that. Light which also, for people in my little sub-component of the human race, the tiny little number of people called the Jews, it comes up, at least as I feel it every year about this time, when we get together or don't talk or nod about what it means to have been enslaved and to have come out of slavery into the ambivalent and complicated condition of freedom in the search for something transcending ourselves, which can be materialized and reified in the idea of the promised land. I think that the love of justice and the hatred of injustice operate not as though they were built upon a simple opposition, but as though they were two different directions into the nature of a lawyer's life. Not necessarily present for one and absent for the other, and indeed, as you will expect, it seems to me that the meaning of creativity in a lawyer's work is that she has not merely one or the other motive, but that she has learned over the course of her life in school and in practice and in society and in the world of moral and ethical conflict in society, she has come to see both a love of justice that is of the construction of the things that make our lives more fair, more decent, more honorable, and more interaccountable, if you like, on the one hand, and her motive to triumph over that which makes our life more wrong, more bitter, more unequal, more unfair, more oppressive, and therefore, in some equally important way, less meaningful. The love of justice is, I believe, the meaning of our constructive understanding of the promised land, of the good life, of the just society, the love of building it and preserving it and making it clean and new all the time as it is beat upon by the weather and the force of human weakness, to be always improving something. Whereas the hatred of injustice isn't merely anger or violence or aggression, and it isn't merely the paths of glory. The triumph that we have in hating injustice is also from time to time a triumph over ourselves, as Christian moral thinking is particularly likely to point out. An effort to subdue those elements of our nature, whether individually or collectively, which allow us to ignore the rights, the needs, the dignities, the purposes of others, in order to make what amounts to an idol of ourselves. In this sense, then, though I understand and take responsibility for the form in which the lives of John Brown and Martin King are seen in relation to the hatred of injustice, that it is also important to understand the other part of how it works. For Martin King, of course, the weight of Christian understanding imposes a doubt about hate, an effort to subdue and overcome and even, it would be fair to say, to obliterate hate, not outside, but inside the soul. In order to do which, it may be necessary to have the courage, the heartfulness, the internal moral self-sufficiency, not merely to reject aggression on one's own side, but to be fearless about it from elsewhere. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Because after all, the transformative experience of the possession of real courage, of the heart intent upon its own higher purpose, is that the fear that ordinarily imposes upon us some watchfulness over our own interests, some desire to have our best material and reputational foot forward, well, it just doesn't matter very much. You can get into law school without courage. You know. I mean, you know. As you can get into medical school without courage. They don't check at the door in either place. I'm a little bit disappointed in that as the decades go by. I think to myself, it would be nice if we had a chance to point an instrument like a thermometer at somebody on his or her way into law school and check the courage reading. I admit that it might be unsuitable to leave out those whose temperature of courage doesn't rise to some numerical minimum, but I'm also very much aware that teaching courage, unlike teaching many other things that lawyers need to have, is beyond my power, and I begin to believe, after all these years of doing it, that it will always be beyond my power. I don't think teaching courage is altogether possible. And I know, of course, that the medical school doesn't make any attempt at it, or nursing school. And yet, out there in this city of mine and maybe yours, where 7,350 people have died in these last weeks of a disease to which no human being is immune. The courage of the doctors and the nurses and the other professionals and paraprofessionals taking care of all these wounded people. The courage to face the reality that the society which has shaped the disease has also shaped their danger in caring for it. Has sent them out to do the jobs that face death with inadequate shielding and without a thought about it. Well, I don't mean without a thought about it. I mean without varying their behavior despite their thoughts about it. They go on. Of course, they do not measure the disease according to its injustice. As I've tried to suggest, from where we are in our various isolation wards, we certainly should. It's not that they ought to think about the disease as shaped primarily by injustice. Clinically, it is shaped by the interaction between the pathogen, the host, and the environment in ways which their courage is directed at helping at no small risk to themselves. But to see them doing that without a sense of injustice needing to be vanquished is surely not at all hard. For us, it should be part of what we take for granted. And if we are lucky enough that we may appear by telephone in the United States Supreme Court rather than having to get on the train and show up there ourselves as we usually do, nonetheless, it is overwhelmingly important to recognize that our luxury is shaped by our ability to create a justice system which treats lawyers with respect and dignity and... If it doesn't, we need to have the courage to do something about it. I want to emphasize that point about courage because it is obviously not the same as force. Because courage is just as important in the construction of the thing, in the loving of justice, if you like, as it is in the vanquishing of the radical injustice. And indeed, as we experience what our society is now going through, we recognize that those who will, as the President of the United States wishes us to, go into battle with the invisible enemy, perhaps carrying guns we have bought at the necessary gun stores, the truth is that the vanquishing of the injustice, which is the disease arising from the virus, will be done long before our effort to reconstruct and rebuild and make better and more fair and more equal and less harmful to the, well, you see. We shall be making justice out of this long after we have done whatever we have done about the injustice of the disease, as one would expect that we would be assiduously directing ourselves at rebuilding after the triumph of the radical injustice that is slavery. You might have said that reconstruction was the most important part of the process of winning freedom, not the war. You might have said that. But this is why the patience of those who love justice has to be long and deep and ductile, compared to the impatience of those whose labor it is to subdue injustice and to build on its bones. The hardest part of lawyering is counseling, in my opinion. The most subtle part, the most complicated part, the one least easy to teach, moreover, the part that has to do with helping clients build and planning for the stress of what they build from external forces, chance and adversariality and economic variability and predation. To help a client plan is not the same as to plan for a client. And counseling, which is of course about the love of justice, order, cleanliness, reliability, the love of helping good people to make good decisions and implement them wisely, is deeply rewarding. As teaching is when you can do it. But it also requires not the martial courage of the people who win battles, but the patient resolve to tell the truth and to force human beings reluctantly to confront the parts of things that they do not wish to understand. Which also requires courage. The most powerful man in the world is not alone in liking to hear the news he wants to hear and having a tendency to undermine or punish or exile or abuse those who bring the news he does not want to hear. When we are engaged in that portion of our work which is constructive, our creativity is deployed in two directions. One, to be fertile in solutions, to be capable of thinking up ways that it might interest a client to order her affairs, but also to be adept in making suggestions in such a way that they will not meet unnecessary resistance, nor require sugarcoating in order to have the effect desired in bringing the client to a sense of what's possible and what is not. The courage to deliver the real news and not to be swayed by the client's powerful prejudices and large-scale Twitter following is not quite the same as the courage to face enemy fire or the courage necessary to stand against the community in the interests of the client whom one may not oneself particularly admire or respect. But all of them hinge upon a truthfulness to self, an honoring of the what is in the heart, the courage that comes from, as both Brown and King, if not I or you, would put it, to the certainty of doing God's will. And that in itself requires a confidence about the relationship of one's own knowledge to the future, whether because one knows the income, the Internal Revenue Code, or because one knows the nonprofit law of New York State, or because one understands what the prosecutor will take for a deal. But also because what you are doing, whatever it is that you are doing in your practice, is true to what you understand to be the meaning of your practice, its purpose. Tactically, that may be almost anything at any given moment, but strategically, it must serve the objectives that one has set for one's practice, and only one's own objectives are those that one's practice really has. It is, of course, ridiculous to talk about planning, however, at a moment at which the best of us cannot plan at all. And this is why, in order to be in law school at the present hour, one has to both understand what law school is for, and yet at the other hand, be willing to accept that law school is failing in its purpose. I, at least, see no way of declaring otherwise. At this moment in the process of becoming a lawyer, at the turn of this first year when everything is beginning either to seem like it is infused with the vein popping tension of exams, or else has ceased to be about that because you've broken through the barrier of external judgment and have realized that the reason you're in law school isn't to gain the approval of your teachers, but to become a lawyer, the lawyer you want to become, about which you are beginning to have some idea. This is the moment at which that process really starts in earnest. And like the first semester, where some people have picked up law talk quicker than other people have, and therefore the grades, those all-important grades, will reflect an accident of timing rather than anything deeply important, it also does not matter whether at this stage, at the very end of the first year of law school, in the waning weeks of the second term, you have already begun to understand that the only thing that matters is which kind of lawyer you want to be, or whether that is still hovering uncertainly on the other side of the concerns about the exams, the grades, the interviews. It doesn't really matter. Those weeks, whether it occurs that you are aware of yourself as wanting to be a lawyer and have a practice and to shape it for yourself, whether that happens in April of 2020 or in November of 2020 or March of 2021 will never matter. You will have this practice of yours, whatever you turn it into and whatever you change it into after that, and whatever you change it into after that, you will have this practice for decades. The moment at which you began to realize that it actually exists, that it is your boat and you could be sailing it, it doesn't matter whether that occurs at the end of the first year or the middle of the second, it's irrelevant. If it never occurred at all, then Martha Tharo's concern is real that there could come a day when in that dimness you discover that time went by and you didn't know what it was that was really at stake, and then there's nothing to do but drag other people down into your misery. That image of hers is really just about what it means to have no idea what is the meaning of your practice. That's what should be happening now, but it can't happen now. Okay, it doesn't matter. As I say, it will happen later instead of now. That doesn't make much difference. The problem is that the reason it cannot happen now is partly the physical separation, the isolation from law school. Law school is both negative and positive all the time, as you're probably aware, but one of the positive sides of being together at that moment is that a lot of people, all seeking, whether they know it or not, to begin to feel the reality of the practice that they want to shape, together is good. In the summer, one goes and one exists around other lawyers, at least one used to, and they don't know what the meaning of their practice is. They're dull the way Tharo says they are. They're trapped in an understanding you can see Carl Wiley trapped in, fully aware of the value of their skills, whatever their opinion may be about the justice of the market price they happen to be worth, nonetheless aware of being worth it. but not exactly sure what it is that generates worthiness besides the money. So in that sense, being with a bunch of law students all seeking to understand what it means to have a practice, including a smattering of foreign lawyers we shall not see again around our halls for a while, who have some idea of that but have come to the United States to do something about it, which is not available within the terms of reference of the practice they've already built at home, to be in the presence of all those people seeking to understand what it means to have a professional identity and to begin to control it is a better environment for understanding than that in which a variety of, well, men and women will be leading what our friend Henry David Thoreau called lives of quiet desperation. And we're not together, so that's not happening. But that's only half the problem. The other half the problem is that there is a way of teaching how to take on that task of having a practice and shaping it your way. At least I think there is a way of teaching that. At least I've tried for a couple of decades now to figure out what that way was, but it doesn't work in this telephone booth. It doesn't work as a podcast. This is not to denigrate podcasts, but it's not the way it works. Perhaps if we all were compelled to stay inside for another 30 years, after 33 years of that, I would know how to help people learn that in a pot, but I don't think so. And at any rate, I don't have another 33 years, and you don't either. Here we are now. So here now, we're trying to understand how to imagine one's career, one's practice, one's trajectory of life as a lawyer while the society itself is being atomized and broken down and its incapacities are being radically displayed. And the economy upon which the self-satisfaction of a place like Columbia Law School so deeply depends is being torn up by the roots, and we do not know what we will plant next seed time. In that sense, it would appear to be an awfully bad time to be trying to understand how to have a practice. And as I said, 2 weeks ago, there will no doubt be a very substantial flight to safety about that. Oh my God, I have no idea what the world will be like when I get out of law school. I really, really, really need a job with a large thing that knows. But of course, the large thing that knows is a hypothetical animal. All the large things do not know. In the same way that we all do not know, they do not know. If they were presented with the Great Depression, would they know what to do with it at Oreck or Crevath? And the answer is no, they would not know. They did not know then. They do not know now. Their history is no more a guide to them than it is to any of the other great amnesiac institutions of the United States, like, say, the White House. Nobody knows how to do the things in society which are going to make the most difference with respect to the nature of the world over the next decade. Nobody knows operationally or conceptually what to do. There are historical positions, programs, political parties, social theories, and economic prescriptions, all of which have something to say about what would happen if you globalized the world economy, made all the supply chains interdependent on massively complicated, capitalistically organized international flows, and then stopped it all on a dime, kept it out of order and deliberately paralyzed to different extents in different places over different periods of time, in which enormous social instabilities and conflicts were being bred in dozens of different directions, and the primary voices of international and national order had fallen largely mute, including the personal incapacities and intellectual inabilities of the single most powerful human beings on the planet. Nobody knows how to restart this all, as we are currently saying, to open up or reboot the system we have known. Nobody knows how it can be done. It will be muddled through, no doubt. We are not going to take this moment behind a veil of ignorance and reshape the entirety of global human society in the interest of justice in some Rawlsian, Ackermanian, higher track moment of human lawmaking. We are going to try to resuscitate, as we say, normal, but it isn't going to work. From one point of view, then, the problem of owing a bunch of money for having gone to law school and being in a position where even the flight to safety, I shall take the job with the biggest, safest, most aggressively establishment firm there is and work my ass off to gain a partnership, even that is not actually a hedge against the deep uncertainties now occupying global society, the global economy, the legal profession, higher education in America, and everything down to the cruise line industry. It is, in that sense, going to be hard to counsel yourself, or for me or any other onlooker to counsel you. The emotional consequences of the obvious inability to plan are debilitating. More debilitating in inverse proportion to your absence of experience, of course, right? All primate human types, all hominids, so far as I can guess, and as the record will show us, have a tendency to assume, right, that what happened yesterday will happen again today. And when they know it won't, that produces an absence of landmarks in temporal sequence, which, like the absence of landmarks in physical perception, induces a mental state known as panic. And so, deprived of the opportunity, reason by induction, that the stock market will come up tomorrow because it came up today, we are, of course, a little panicky. Whatever are the metrics we carry around in our head, as the President of the United States pointing at his own head and declaring that his metrics were in there, he was right about that. It's not necessarily highly desirable in political authority, but it is definitely the way it works for human beings. Our metrics are in our heads. We really don't have external metrics, and when we know that our internalized metrics aren't going to work, the result is internal conflict among personality states unaccustomed to the effort to live together, thrown upon one another much as though they were a family in isolation, suddenly required to figure out how to get along or else. Apparently, then, counseling is difficult, and indeed, if you're engaged in any form of social work, whether it is lawyering or therapy, at the present moment, you will have to admit, as everybody I know in any of those and the other jobs admit, everybody we deal with is a little bit psychically distorted these days. But there is actually a way to understand what's going on that is less frightening. Of course, I say this to you inside my telephone booth or before March 4th, sometimes not in my telephone booth, sometimes in an actual place called a classroom where we did the thing which for the last 200,000 years has been known as teaching. There is a way to feel more confident if only you could find out what's in your heart, if only you could know your courage just a little bit. Every time I say that the purpose of knowing that you have a practice is to know that it's yours and to be self-sufficient in it, even you, the self-selected people who were willing to put up with me, who signed up for this back when it was a different thing you were signing up for, even you, you get resistant. Oh, no, he's not really telling us we should go out into the world and practice alone. And well, no, actually, I've never said to you that you should practice alone. You do practice alone now, as I do, in the sense that there's never anybody there right now. But of course, knowing how to choose partners, knowing how to find mentoring, knowing how, well, to make your network work for your practice is all about not practicing alone. If you find, as I have found in my professional life, even one superb partner who it really suits you to practice with, then you are lucky. But you will always practice with people. The metaphorical container of the things you know how to do, the license, can be pawned. You can always raise money on the license. You take it to somebody and you trade it for a salary. That's fine. You should know exactly why. You should know exactly for how long. You should be extremely clear about the amount of the loan and what you're going to pay in the end for it. The transaction of the pawning of a license is not just the ordinary, well, every lawyer has a job. The pawning of a license is a strategic and tactical decision. And it should be made with an understanding of both its purpose and its end. But the same is true of a law partnership and an office lease and a relationship with a client. That is to say, of course, lawyers' lives are purposive in that sense. We're spooky about that. We know why we're doing what we're doing. And when we don't, we seek to find out. We investigate. We interrogate ourselves. We investigate our decisions. We interrogate our motives. We try to get to the bottom of it. And in trying to get to the bottom of the rejection of self-sufficiency as the goal of legal education and the building of one's practice, why do we recoil from that? The answer is, well, simply because we are afraid of what we do not know. This is not the time to be teaching you how to operate a practice. Though, if we could be in the same room in the fall, I would be happy to start. Because by then you would have decided to come back and you would know that you mean to have a practice, and then it would be perfectly respectable to say, but I am afraid because I do not have the vaguest idea how to operate a practice. And how could I survive if I didn't know how to operate? And the correct answer is no, you couldn't. But you can learn the basics about how to survive and operate a practice, and then you can practice and you'll get better at it. And then you say, but I do not wish to have all that risk myself. And I say, yes, you wish to diversify. You wish to share. You wish to find other people who will absorb with you the risks of operating a practice and chicken today and feathers tomorrow, which is always a possibility. Oh, then, of course, you could always go and pawn the license to somebody who has a flock of chickens and hope they let you eat off the good parts and not merely the part that went over the fence last. Which is, of course, what they plan to do, because they don't like the part that went over the fence last, and they're always going to keep the better pieces for themselves. That's what it means when you pawn your license. In the world that is going to rise after the end of the period of the plague, there will be lots of problems. vast unwindings of the kind that Celia Day was thinking about on that train one day. It's not just the World Trade Center that came down. We tried in due course this Celia Day's experiment, and maybe you have figured out how Larry Silverstein wound up trying to get his insurers to pay for the buildings that were knocked over and what happened in that litigation. At least I hope you did. So unlike what Judge Day imagines, and yet so fundamentally like everything she has to say about the law. But as everybody around the world is now beginning to figure out, a couple of light irregulars equipped with a bunch of heavy fuel oil flying airplanes into a pair of buildings in New York and into one squat piece of heavy masonry in Washington, D.C., that's not really as big a deal as this. But all of the unwinding and the complexity and the stress and the legislation and the arbitration and the mediation and the commission investigations and the Ken Feinberg's system for giving away money, all of that in the world of the aftermath of September 11th, 2001, multiplied by four orders of magnitude at least, is what the world will be going through when the plague recedes and everybody comes out of hiding. What happens in the months and year, let us say, or two following the end of the plague will characterize another decade or decade and a half of life around the world. The shape of human society and the trajectory of human history for a significant period of time that we could characterize as something like a third of your working lifetime will be spent in the world of the unwinding and reconstruction of economic, social, and political life after the plague. There will, in this I agree with the dean, offering her marketing speech to those who might sign up for could-be online law school in the fall, I agree with the dean, there will always be need for lawyers, but that's not all of what I mean. The particular need for legal creativity in the aftermath of the plague should be sinking in with you right now. You should recognize that we will be in a world in which there will be an enormous pile of needs and an already shrinking pile of resources as those who own become less generous than they were in the midst of the plague. One of the most interesting things about teaching English legal history, a subject I have taught for quite a long time and may never teach again and certainly don't mean to teach you now, but one of the interesting things about English legal history as it was created at the end of the 19th century as an academic discipline by Frederick William Maitland is that English legal history in its first 100 years of existence as a professional discipline had very little to say about the plague. The great demographic crisis of England in the middle of the 14th century, which everybody knew was there, everybody learned about it, professional historians didn't think the plague didn't happen or that it wasn't important. But Maitland's extraordinary emphasis as the founding scholar in the new scientific history of law in England, Maitland's emphasis upon the records was so overwhelmingly important. His prescriptivism about the difficulty of explaining the immense wealth of written records that the English had meant that it was easy to say about the plague, well, we just don't know because it's not in the documents. We just can't say. And it's not surprising in a way, therefore, that in the growth of English legal history as an academic discipline, it would have been, had to be, an American scholar who first sort of said, you know, that's ridiculous. Well, whatever is in the documents, we have to figure out what happened. And Robert Palmer's English Law in the Age of the Black Death, which was published when I was already a young scholar myself, was the first time in more than 600 years that somebody decided to work backward from the plague and not forward as Maitland had instructed from the records. And when you do that, you rediscover what the social historians of the 19th century, not just the Marxist A ones, but everybody discovered, which was, of course, that the plague produced a wave of oppression as the owners of the land sought to get their labor back at a price that they could regard as suitable, despite the fact that there were a lot fewer laborers than there were before, and they had leverage in the grand social bargain, the failure of which ultimately resulted in 1381 in the largest working class uprising in the history of England. We will have, when the Bezoses and the Gateses of the world get done making grand gestures with tiny quantities of their wealth, and when Tories have temporarily subsidized wages, faute de mieux, rather in failure of any alternative, never mind a better one, there will be a turn towards the recapturing of property and power by those who have temporarily been willing to appear to give up substance in return for social peace at a time of pestilence when ensuring social peace means making hard cash down payments rather than mumbling about premiums. It is lovely to think that what will happen in the United States is we'll get a national health service and some other trappings of social democracy out of this. Before, as Franklin Roosevelt said in 1935, those who were ill are now well enough to throw their crutches at the doctor, though he meant only those who were economically ill, of course. It might be pleasant to suppose that global federalism will take another step forward as humanity realizes that public health cannot be conducted on a bordered basis, nor can climate change be fought that way. And I won't say, standing here in my telephone booth, that that's not going to happen, that it is certain not going to happen. I have no idea, but I will say for sure that if it does happen, it will happen after great conflict, and that conflict, we can hope, will be conducted mostly by those who love justice and those who hate injustice, and not just those who bought a bunch of ammunition at the store. In other words, there is all kinds of lawyering to do on behalf of all sorts of people on all sides as the decade that follows the end of the pestilence is a decade of contestation over the new society around the world being built in the aftermath of what has happened. It seems, we can hope, apparent that we will not have the scale of death that came to the world in 1919. Perhaps it will not be 50 million dead before it's over. Perhaps we shall be so lucky in this unlucky United States that even though we will have among the worst records for dealing with this pestilence in all the developed world, perhaps we shall not lose 250,000 people. Maybe we shall not even lose 100,000 people. Maybe we will not have sustained more casualties than in all our wars since 1945, or maybe we will. But whatever happens next, the effort to secure both justice for those around you who need more than the post-pestilence order will offer them, and all the work of reconstructing fortunes and rebuilding leverages that will be out there for those of you who want to work for leverages and increase fortunes, there will be no shortage of work to do, but it will require new thinking. And here is your great advantage, after all. There will need to be a lot of new thinking. Sometimes that new thinking will express itself as old thinking improved. Sometimes that new thinking will express itself as careful conversations with staff on the House Ways and Means Committee, in which the level of creativity involved is nothing more than the usual seeking of temporary monetary advantages for one taxpayer or a class of taxpayers. But new thinking, it will be nonetheless. And it will have the quality that new thinking always has. It will be done primarily by new people. To say of science that it advances one funeral at a time, that scientists are less likely to give up hypotheses than they are to give over their professorships to people with new hypotheses, may not be literally true, although as the sociology of science goes, it's a pretty good hypothesis for investigation. But the world of the later 2020s and the early 2030s will be the world of younger lawyers, as the 1930s were. And you will be the oldest young lawyers on the block. Your clock started running on your practice when everything changed. I recognize that this is not what they will say at EIP whenever they get around to holding late early interview program next year. I've always wondered where the late interview program was, and it had never occurred to me that when it became necessary to have the early interview program late, it would be necessary still to call it EIP. But whenever it occurs, they will have a different story. Their story will be the flight to safety. And the message will be, as the message at EIP always is, gee, it's a shame your grades aren't a little better, or you could be a person in our law firm. and you will not necessarily be able to suppress your understanding that the person on the other side of the desk saying this is a dinosaur, but you will try. Because already it will have begun to occur to you that after the asteroid hits, that they may look very big and you may look very small and tentative, but actually the world belongs to mammals. It's just a question of the time scale. So what you can plan on is an embarrassment of riches. If riches constitute work for lawyers to do that will require new ways of doing it. That's not only about concept. That's not only about results. It's not only to say that what you know how to do, the metaphorical contents of your license will be repacked, reordered, and changed from what other people's licenses contained, even so recently as the day before yesterday. It's also to say that you will be sociologically adapted to pursue a form of lawyering in which uses of technology and global interconnection, in which networking has a meaning both literal and figurative different from what it had before, in that world you will understand how to construct young practices that can be profitable and can lead to comfort and safety for you from moment to moment in your life as you are constantly changing that practice, in ways that the larger and more inflexible organizational structures of law practice in the 20th century cannot do in the 21st. The large practices for which you think you want to work are now busy cutting wages. They're trying not to fire too many people, but they're incapable of survival at the levels of income presently available to them. And so they're busy impoverishing their associates by taking their savings back and putting it in the partnership's pocket. This will go on for as long as the current paralysis goes on. And you will not be conscious of it because associates don't go around ballyhooing how their wages have been cut. And the EIP approach to the world is, we are the source of wealth and power. We are the only form of safety available. You should come and work for us while we cut the wages of the people who already work for us until such time as we can go back to being profitable the way we used to be, which is never coming back, or until we have a vaccine against our inability to imagine, which could happen and may be in trials tomorrow. But still, it wouldn't be what you wanted any more than if in 1935 you had been offered a choice between a job in the new federal government of Felix's boys, on the one hand, or an opportunity to go to work for the greatest firm in Duluth, on the other. We cannot plan what will happen next. We cannot plan what your practice will be like, but we can plan its meaning in this period. When you have decided what balance of the creativity to build and the strength of heart and courage to fight what has been built in evil, when you can figure out what balance you want between aggression and construction, not 0 and 100, not necessarily 50-50, but I'd like to do a little of this and I'd like to do a little of that, and I'd take on a third thing if between the three of them they would be counter-cyclical to one another, and I could pretty much be sure that I'd always be able to make my nut. And it would be good if I had an older partner to begin with and a younger partner right after that. And I should have some idea about the nature of the people that I need around me. And I should be beginning to figure out how to go and find them. That you can do. Not only can you do it, but you should do it. Not only should you do it, but no matter how often or to whom you decide to pawn your license, knowing that will always serve you well. As it will always serve you well to know how to make it live. Will my practice survive? I don't know. I don't know, among other things, whether I'm going to survive. You have much more certainty about your relationship to mortality than I do right now. I have more certainty about what my practice is because I've had it for a very long time, and for the past 15 years I have been operating it in a way which was larger in scale and ambition than I had had before, and maybe than you have yourself right now. Perhaps you don't want to spend 15 years paying a sky-high rent for a floor of an office building on Manhattan Island. That's perfectly understandable. I didn't either. And I was poorly trained in law school, even compared to you, or I should say quite compared to you, because I went to some place where lawyering was even more despised and looked down upon than it is here, at the great Yale Law School. So when it came time to make my practice larger in my 40s and to carry it through my 50s and to produce something which would have a big nut and a lot of people in it, I had no idea how. Not really. And contrary to the myth that experience of the great large law firm teaches you, trains you to do that, I can assure you that nothing that I learned at Cravath about how to run a law practice was ever relevant to the law practice that I ran. There were things I admired about the large law practice with which I was briefly associated, but its operational relevance to the doing of it myself was not one of them. You should leave law school knowing that you have a practice, having some idea of what that practice means to you, and having had the experience while in law school of planning for it, thinking about it, recognizing of what moving parts it would be constructed if it were the practice that you want to have. Of course, all of that will change. How to operate a practice is not the same in the year 2020 than it was when I began operating a larger law practice in 2005. let alone what it was when I learned what I learned about how to do it from the people that I learned from, Judge Weinfeld, Justice Marshall, the Cravath partners, in the 1980s. Obviously, the meaning of practice changes over time, too, both with respect to the material structure of what you need and with respect to the meaning socially that you want your life at any given moment to have. What I wanted my practice to do for me at 45 is not what I want it to do for me at 60, let alone for whom I want the practice to succeed. Rather, the experience of knowing that there is going to be a new world, that you could shape your practice to the ends of having the life you want in the new world, without knowing exactly what that world will be or what that practice is merely practice in imagining. And you should do that. Whether we are really together in the fall or only moving our education online will matter to the quality of your education. As a longtime connoisseur of law school, if you could put it that way, I would not pay a dime for an online law school. But never mind even that, though it's a powerful and important element, should you go on leave for a political campaign in the fall and come back later when law school has learned how to be face to face again, another subject for another day. I don't mean at this time of the hour to start another rabbit running. But no matter even the most important apparent distinction, which is whether we are doing our jobs right or we are doing our jobs wrong in the fall, nonetheless, from this instant forward, given that the exams are very little pressure in a pass-fail world and all that garbage, those invisible bullets people are constantly being shot with, has been carted off and buried for the day. From this moment, you should be saying to yourself, because I know you're coming back, nobody's going to leave now. Even though now would be a particularly good time to leave, everybody's going to come back, if only so they can see people again and that they reassure themselves about the reality of their experiences. When you come back, you should be thinking to yourself, new world, new practice. First generation in the post world of the post-pestilence, post-America, post-Trump, post-internationalism, all that stuff, and also post the world in which people could think to themselves it had nothing to do with economic and social injustice that black folks get sick more than white folks. We're going to be able, whenever it is that we see one another again, to know more about the world of the future than we know today. We will gain insight as we go, a little bit, as the pestilence decreases its grip and as the incompetents running the societies of the world get together and have their opening up commissions and do everything they're going to do. But it doesn't really matter now. You're shooting at a moving target called a future nobody understands. You know that the problems that interest you will be, unfortunately, commonplace, whatever they are. You know that the redistribution of the redistribution of the redistribution will be going on fiendishly from one side and perhaps hopefully from the other for quite a many years to come. And therefore, there will be room for your spookiness. And the spookier you are, the better. But that's only clear from the point of view of a man nearly at the end of the process. It's hard to be clear about that when you are a young person seeking to build a life in the law now. It looks, to the extent that one can see anything from one's isolate booth, it looks tougher than it used to be. It isn't true. It looks as though impacted power and establishment will have the inside. It isn't true. It looks as though only those with the deepest of backing can succeed against the harshness of the economic environment. It isn't true. it will feel true. Or rather, there are people who will try and make you feel it's true, and when I say it isn't, there will be people who will tell you that, you know, Edmund's crazy. I'm not. This is still the pestilence. And after the pestilence, there will still be much pain and mourning and suffering and deep injustice. But it will also be seed time. And you will be clever, agile, thoughtful, young people. Unburdened with expectations about the normal that has to be restored. And if you use that, you will thrive. And then, of course, there's EIP, whenever it is. Never too early. That is, you are caught up in other people's dreams of normal. How higher education will be just fine, how large law practices will be just fine, how Wall Street will be just fine, how project finance will be just fine. You are caught up in other people's expectations. They will need you to build that world in which they were normally on top. And there will be work doing that too, you can be sure. Apparently well remunerated. As long as the psychic opportunity costs in meaningfulness are not too deeply considered. It would be good to talk about this together. We won't get that chance, I guess. Not now, anyway. But if we happen to meet on an etherpad soon, or have some other mode of personal exchange, you know what my first question would always be. Can you feel, even now, even at the height of the horror, can you feel the need for you developing out there in society? Can you feel it? See, the will of God, you know, it delivers itself all at once, from the burning bush, on Mount Sinai, in the book, in the preached word that yields the process of conversion, rebirth. The beauty of the will of God is how clear it is, compared to the hard secular problem of reading one's heart as though only one had made it. But to see those in bondage and to be held in bond with them, to see the naked and to clothe them, to see the hungry and to feed them, the simplicity of it is also the newness of it. Gibbon is right that among the reasons that Christianity triumphed in the pagan world was the sense of meaning and purpose that the church itself had and could convey to all those who joined it and to all those who might join it. Yet this also has to do with the history of epidemic disease in the Mediterranean basin, in the middle of the second century, and then again in the sixth, well, that too. But the discovery that if you search your heart, if you find your courage, if you know what it is that's worth living and dying for, that you can make out of the material of the world that is being broken up and reconstructed around you what you need to live the life that's good for you, you can find that even without the delivery of the principle on tablets or the voice from the burning bush. And I will say, as some said before me about that, I may not get there with you, but I know that you will get there before too long. Talk to you soon.